This is the second hour of our third program in our miniseries with Michael Cesarion. We are talking about the Mysterium, or the Disciples of the Mysterium, a philosophical discussion basically about reality, tyranny, control, but also the mind and our relationship to the world and this experience that we're having here. Basically, where we left off, we were talking about the world today, pretty much, and how all of this that we've been discussing in the first hour is very much applicable today. We're right at the cusp of where we almost can see the Tower of Babel coming down, falling down. And again, multitude and diversity is nothing that is being encouraged in our world today. It's all about oneness and kind of homogenized thinking. And basically with that, unfortunately as well, freedom is heading out the door. Comments on that, Michael?
Well, absolutely. That's why philosophy and sociology, psychology are so important, because we're not going to be able to understand what's happening. You know, science talks about the future always. It always talks about a collective, because everything in science is not the product of one man. It's a product of a chain of individual scientists working towards a certain end, whether that end is, you know, the global village or even something more positive. It doesn't really matter. It's collectivist by its nature, in exactly the same way that religion was collectivist in the past, because there's two mysteriums. There's now the technological mysterium, and Heidegger did talk about this a lot. He always spoke extensively on the difference between the poets and the technological people. But the religious mysterium of a few decades ago, and of course it still exists somewhat, but it's pretty much dead on its feet, that always was collectivist as well, because it was one set of rules for every human being, one Ten Commandments for every human being, one church for all human beings, and one heaven. There wasn't many different kinds of heaven, right? There was one heaven, one God, one mediator, one church, one set of rules. This is collectivist. Mm. I don't know why people don't notice this. Technology has the same attitude in a slightly different way. It just says that one scientist cannot hope in his own lifetime to uncover the whole secret of everything. So science will. But then that is collectivist in its nature, is it not?
Well, peer reviewing, what is that all about, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. First of all, yeah, exactly. First of all, you have to be part of the hierarchy in order to even become a scientist that's going to get anywhere. Because we know that these criminals like the Oppenheimers and Zillards that I mentioned, for every one of those jokers, there's a Tesla, a Walter Russell, and a Wilhelm Reich standing in the off at stage exit left, you know, out of the limelight.
Yeah.
So there's no answer there. But even philosophically, they're implying that the utopia to which they're leading you is a collectivist one. No one scientist will know it. They're all links in a chain. No one culture will know it in your lifetime. Now, this is very, very important, because if you tie it back into Taoism and aspects of what Heidegger was saying, you'll see more clearly what the difference is. The Taoist and Heidegger are saying, look, anything that promises you any kind of collectivistic, all-encompassing answer is part of the mysterium. You know, it's not legit. Who is to say that you, in an individual life, should not gain all knowledge about all things, including yourself and the world, in your lifetime? No organization today promises you this, and it's because Heidegger said that all philosophy, all of the world, has never been addressing the true meaning of Das Ein, which is existence and being. The Taoist is not interested in these movements because he knows that they're pursuing something that's totally elusive. And it doesn't matter what they build, they're never going to attain it. And they haven't attained it. The theologians and the idealists and the rationalists never attained the goals of reason that they offered to explain the world. It didn't happen in almost 1,000 years. Plato's forms are still as abstract as they were when he lived, and so forth and so on, you see.
Yeah.
And even though Immanuel Kant was the philosopher, it would take too long to explain this, but Immanuel Kant is extremely important because he's the one who tried to pacify and resolve the issues that stood between the so-called materialist philosophers, the empiricists, as they're called, and the rationalists. We don't have time to explore that, but I have done in the article if people want to look at that. But Immanuel Kant had to endorse the God idea. In other words, he was still mysterium possessed. He himself did slyly say, I know that the God doesn't exist. But as Voltaire said, if God didn't exist, it would be necessary to invent him, meaning that Kant and Voltaire and these rationalists suddenly started to admit, just before the time of Heidegger, that look, we know that there is no real God, but he's a necessary idea in your mind. Again, so in other words, they're endorsing the mysterium. They're not letting it go.
And
so everyone
that, sorry to cut you off. Does that mean, in your point of view, that they're then dismissing the truth? They're they're hinging it on an illusion because it's safer with it than without it in a way.
Yes, they're closing the door of one mysterium only to open a door to another mysterium. They don't return back to the answer, the reality.
Yeah,
which is why Heidegger critiqued them. And this is where the atheists and the positivists and the atomists are basically neo-Kantians. They take up Kant and say, good man, thanks a lot for telling us that God is just an idea in people's minds. That's what we were trying to tell these rationalists. So now we can run over into the pluralistic world where everybody's conception of reality, and in my opinion, a distorted version of reality, is now the real.
Yeah.
And therefore, the empiricist is now justified by Kant by saying, oh yeah, we know that there's no real God, but it's a working idea. This left the door open for them to not only endorse the previous mysterium, but to create another mysterium in their own minds. Specifically, that mysterium is a false understanding of nature. Because as we said, that's why we did it kind of in reverse. The mysterium that haunts the materialist is the behaviorist Calvinist thing we were talking about before, in which there is no consciousness either in the mind of man or in nature at all. And therefore, this opens the way to technology, does it not? Because then the technology can say, we see man as just a machine, and so is the universe as a machine, with programmable, understandable principles. Remember I said that the ego secretly wants to discover the meaning of the negentropia of nature? This all then opens the door to this. But there's another element to this as well, and it has to do with violence. They've known them when they study, when criminologists are studying rapists, they often understand that the rapist has a strange ambivalence, sadomasochistic tendency. He wants to murder and mutilate and hurt the object, his victim, but he also wants to own and possess and love, although that love is, of course, necrotic.
Yeah.
Right? He wants to fall in love with it. And in fact, many women have been able to pacify themselves from being raped by actually talking to the lunatic and then making him a cup of coffee and all this kind of shit and acting like he's a real human being type of thing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
This is all part of this. So all psychopaths operate this way. And technology is a sharpened weapon in which they wish to stab and probe into nature, but at the same time immerse themselves in a sort of orgiastic way into nature. This is born from my theory that originally you cut off from nature, but you can't cut that which is born from nature off from nature. At the end of the last segment, we just said that nature, a man falsely sees nature as separate to himself, but nature did not, man did not create nature. Nature created man. So man, whether he likes it or not, and no matter how artificial man becomes, he cannot deny that he's part of nature, which is what the Taoists and all you see are ultimately resting their theory on.
Yeah.
Okay, but what has happened is man has become estranged from the natural within himself. So his technology then has two functions. One is to sever and dissect, and to mutilate nature in order to reveal her secrets. But it is also a perverse attempt to bond and own back the nature that he won't do in the legitimate way. Isn't this incredible?
Monsanto, patenting of seeds and just legally taking over nature in a way, genetically modified trees even, and then claiming them as your own in a way, your own creation, you know?
Here we go. Yeah. That's it. Putting your stamp on the very cell. Putting your stamp on the DNA. Patenting the DNA.
Yeah.
When you see what we're talking about, you start to understand. They're not listening to Fritz and Francis of Assisi. They're not listening to Feuerbach. They're not listening to Heidegger. They're not listening to the Chuang Tzu and the Lao Tzus. They're not listening to the shaman who said, you and nature are one. What you do to harm nature is to harm yourself. You see these kinds of things?
Mm.
So they don't realize it. First of all, look at it this way. If man was truly not technological but natural, and he allowed nature, which is very mutable, it doesn't have fixed laws like people think, those are just projections. If nature was really to form man, if man allowed himself to be shaped and formed on a daily basis by direct interaction with nature, do you know that we wouldn't even have a civilization or even a society as we know them today?
Probably not. We would probably would be even more, you know, civilized as the true term means in one way, I think.
We would, and we wouldn't have civilization, because civilization is a technological construct which stands against nature, which is the other, making nature an otherness. And then you have to bring in nature under the rules and regulations of the city.
Yeah.
Just
another modern example, sorry to cut you off, but we all know, we who live in the European Union, know about the absurd stories about the angle of a banana, the length of a cucumber, in order to define them as food or what have you. It's regulation, you know, extraordinaire here, you know, and this is all basically boils down to control and also control of nature, farming industry, and the whole shebang, you know?
Yeah, they want roses without thorns. They want cactus without spines. they're never going to be satisfied. And even the preparation of food, Henrik, even the mechanical objects that we have to cut and process food, the thing goes on and on and on into this industrial Cartesian mechanistic setup. And basically, one has to contemplate that a man who is directly in touch with nature is not a primitive. He's not going to become a savage. What he will not have is he will not have the civilizations that we know today. I've often referred to man as we know him as being thrice dead. Like the ancients say, he first of all broke off from the umbilical cord to nature. That was the first breach. Then he created a mysterium to seek for this God idea, in other words, an essence within nature, and he buried himself in that. That's twice dead. And then when that mysterium basically gave up the ghost, another was born, which is the technological model. So he's really thrice dead, is the way I look at it.
I want to talk about one point here that came up as well in regards to basically how we interpret reality and that we project our own belief onto reality and reality in a way responds to that's proven through the Heisenberg principle that you mentioned before, or quantum mechanics, whatever we want to call it. Basically, when we had the announcement of cold fusion by Martin Fleischmann and Stanley Ponce, can't remember exactly when this was quite a few years ago now. The first thing that happened, of course, is that a lot of other scientists come along and try to replicate that experiment. It needs to be, again, peer-reviewed, and it needs to be tested and see if other people can replicate it. But what is happening there potentially as well is because they could not be able to replicate it. So they said, no, it's a fraud. It's a phony. Cold fusion does not work. But what about the problem here then with progress overall, or technological progress? Because with our belief, potentially, we are even clenching progress because we might not believe that it's possible. So we're getting nowhere here, if you follow my train of thought, Michael.
We are getting nowhere because the very science itself is unfounded. There is a philosopher called Wilhelm Windelband who came up with two words to describe what you're talking about. He called it ideographic and nomothetic. Ideographic are meaningful events and experiences that cannot be replicated or ever understood with any absolute general rules or codes. Because ideographic events never really truly repeat themselves. This is what nature's really going on. I think it was Sophocles or one of the other ancient masters who said you can never step on the same piece of water twice.
Exactly, yeah.
Then the nomothetic is those events that occur when you can, in fact, have scientific verifications, you know, through replication and scientific models and so on. But my reading of this is that those are only reproducible because they're not really in reality at all. These are the mental constructs of reason and of this patriarchal, mysterium-possessed mentality. Man can only ever know his own thoughts. In the state that he is in now, he can only prove or disprove the content of his own consciousness. He cannot, in fact, know what is really real about reality until he works out these things, these principles that we're talking about.
That's so interesting.
It's just not possible. This is where this principle of indeterminacy, you see, the uncertainty principle of Heisenberg. They run right into the middle of it yet again, because they have never resolved these issues that Heidegger was pressing them to also understand. And remember, as I said before, it needs to be repeated. Once you have the mysterium in your consciousness, whether it's a theological one or a technological one, the victim is not only nature, the victim is one's own thinking, one's own self. For instance, don't you see how much technology today is focused on the body and the DNA?
Absolutely. It's all about
whether
that.
It's curing AIDS or the brain and curing aging and whatever hell else it is. Mm. This is also the concomitant of this perverse, anti-natural understanding of man's body as being separate from nature, the head being separate from the body, in the way that Wilhelm Reich's whole life work was to explain. And therefore, the probing into the body, all the forms of machinery that they have created, I'm not against it, healing disease, we're talking philosophically here, that the whole idea of this mechanistic understanding of even the human body and animals and so forth and so on, and as I said, there's even been the St. Francis of Assisi's within the religious movement who've begged man to understand that God is nature, nature is God, etc., and you know they haven't bothered listening to this. And it basically boils down to, you see, that when man is born, he has this false ego, this understanding of his own self that Hegel also elaborated on, and that's his handicap. From that handicap, he starts his life process. So he's not interacting with nature anymore. He's not letting nature shape him. He's letting the thoughts of the collective shape him, his parents and everybody else. And then comes along the teachers, along comes the priests, the politicians, each one further immersing man in the mysterium. They're reinforcing the mysterium. They're not taking it away. And therefore, man today is about as estranged from his own selfhood as you could possibly imagine. And this is the danger. That's why only psychology fixes it. It's always the underlining thing of my work, is that you're never going to fix the problems externally because you're in a deadly link. You're in a deadly grip with the world that is then, again, influencing your mind. Then you raise new children and influence them accordingly. You see, technology promises you all the future utopias and what have you. And man is not even remotely aware of his own self. He's not even dealing with his own existence. His existence has become as foreign to him as anything you could possibly imagine. Can you imagine that? A man's own existence. And there is actually a therapy, by the way, if we have time, to give examples of what I mean. For instance, in order to illustrate this, just somebody should put their two hands in front of them and just look at their hands for a moment and philosophically ask themselves, or try to imagine all the things that your own hands have felt and experienced since the time you were born. Now, your hands, not the guy next door, you know, not your partner, nobody else. Your hands have lived in the world. The touch of fur, you know, the touch of water, the pain that you've had catching a football when you were playing games, you see, the feeling of clothes next to your skin. Put your mind back and go right to the very room in which you were born, the cot in which you were laid, the heat of your mother's skin, the first moment that you saw a thing called a window, the first moment that you breathed your first breath of air, you see, the first moment that you saw the color green or saw fire, the first moment that you stroked a dog and felt its fur and its breath on your face. All of these different elements that are pertaining to your existence, your life, that can never be collectivized. They are, in other words, ideographic. They cannot be replicated by anyone because they're yours. They're absolutely yours. People don't think like this anymore. Yeah. They just exist in a sort of a corporatized way in which we're always thinking of everybody else. We're thinking of the global good. Remember all these mysterium projected things?
Yeah.
We have lost contact. What was it like when you first heard a piece of music? What was it like when, as a child, you looked at a painting and were stood stock still because something you saw was now transfixing you? You were transfixed with existence. These things pass by, and we give them secondary or tertiary rating to all the stuff that we're meant to think is important. And that's why you go to school and are put in a uniform. That's why you sit in cubes. That's why you sit in squares. That's why you're regimented from point go, is because you're not meant to think about that. You're not meant, you know, remember the movie, is a very, very good movie to watch in regards to these theories, is the movie Fearless with Jeff Bridges. There's an incredible, several incredible scenes there of how he then becomes aware of his existence rather than his roles in his marriage and his role at work and everything. And he's sitting at a table listening to a friend of his speaking, and he's eating a strawberry. And people just need to go and watch that scene because it exemplifies what we're talking about here. How here is a man who has now become totally immersed in his own existence as he's eating the strawberry while he's just listening to the, you know, the cacophony of the world around him. It's really fascinating.
So the question that arises here as well then is the difficulty also of breaking away from the memes, the mind viruses in a way around us, other people's view of the world, because again, if it's not taught, if you're not familiar with how to do it, that's going to be very difficult to do. And you need to train almost to do it. You need to, in a way, program your own mind, you know, true mind control, so to speak. You need to control your mind not to take in other people's worldview all the time and try to focus on your own. And that's very difficult to do, Michael.
That's right. You have to do an existential reawakening of your own self. Remember, the Tao is not somebody else, something that somebody's going to give you. The Tao is not going to come knocking on your door one day. The Tao begins when you start questioning philosophically who and what you are, and it's apophatic. You're not going to arrive at what the Tao is, which Tao is nothing more than your selfhood. You're not going to arrive at that directly. You must do it through an apophatic means, which is to find out all the things that are standing in the way of your selfhood. What is not selfhood? What are all the factors and forms that are holding you, both metaphysical and other, physical, metaphysical, spiritual, religious, theological, and all the rest of it? What holds you down? Because you are self-incarcerated. Man is self-incarcerated. He's imprisoned by the mysterium. And as long as he is in this mysterium, he has to understand why he wants it. Why has he entered into a relationship with this? He is the self-murdered individual, you see. And by being self-murdered, he murders everything else in the universe. Heidegger used to speak very poetically of how the when you have this, when you're in absence of being, he said, you are what is called Das Mann. There's two words, D-A-S-M-A-N. Das Mann is just the man.
Yep.
not man as an existing being, but man who's just walking in the street. Like we said in the last program, I think Otto Rank's twist on the Thanatos instinct. The Thanatos is really the man in his unawakened state. When you see those things and you realize that that is what's going on, you try to awaken from that. Now, all existentialists have a remedy for it. As I said, I suggest certain meditations that you can do. Just coming into contact. Look at your cells, the cells of your body, how they do not work. There's no oneness in your body.
Explain.
Well, if a cell just suddenly decided, I want to do what I want to do, and started acting against the flow of what nature has decided, that would be an expression of oneness, and it would destroy your body. The body is a product of nature, as is the mind. But what you think about can be a product of the mind, not nature. This is the thing. Man is haunted by his own false ideas of things. They are not the creations of nature, and therefore they do not exist. This is part of, you know, what I'm writing about. But getting back, existentialists have a particular method of their own. They claim that it is so difficult for man to get in touch with being again, and that the only way he can do that, and this is agreed upon by Kierkegaard, Heidegger, and also Sartre, even though they had so many differences, they do agree on one thing, and it's called being unto death. When a man contemplates his own mortality, like really meditates, and by the way, this is the philosophy that opened a great deal of what's called existential literature, like the Hermann Hesses and the Steppenwolfs and Colin Wilson. You see, this also created a lot of film and a lot of books. This entered into literature about a man who then contemplates his own mortality, the finiteness of his own existence. That angst or that anxiety that he's only here for a finite time is what awakens him into the immediacy and the imminence of his own existence. He takes his existence much more seriously when he realizes that sword of Damocles is above his head. We know this is true because anyone who's ever had cancer or anyone who's been brought to death's door, what do they always tell you?
Well, it's like becoming alive again almost. They experience life in a whole new way that they've never done before.
Yeah. This is what this movie Fearless is also about. But just think I lost the trail of thought there. Oh, yes, that's right. It connects to nature again. Remember I was saying that nature creates mind and creates man?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that let's look deeply more into what it means that when we say that nature creates the mind. Scientists and the theologians and most people generally think, they don't think that you have one life to know all there is to know, but there are infinite things to know. Okay, this is axiomatic.
Yeah, indeed.
Axiomatic meaning something that cannot be freaking disproven. I mean, it's a fact of life, right? Okay, so let's just go with that. There are infinite things to learn, and I don't give a damn if you're a scientist and you're trying to learn it through science. Just as a matter of simple fact, there is infinite things to learn, but you only have one life to learn it in, right?
Yep.
Then you say, and I have a mind, which we already agree is finite, and so we discover reason. We have reason, and even the greatest psychologist Kant and all had to finally agree that reason is a good thing, but it is absolutely incompetent to the job. Reason itself cannot know all there is to know in one life because it's limited. It has its limitations. This has been philosophically irrefutably proven that reason is your way to know things, but it is limited. Then you say that your lifespan, which is time, is limited.
Yes.
People might also reflect on the name of Heidegger's book was Being and Time. He was talking about this. Okay, well, wait a minute. You think this is not bloody important that to realize that there's infinite things to know, but you have a limited lifespan in which to know it, and you also have a reason which is limited and can't know it?
What do you want to focus on? What do you want to learn, right?
Well, it comes about like this. Perhaps then the Taoists were right by saying that the very idea that you can know something in time is illusionary. Which is, again, what I would say is a off concomitant of the mysterium that is deluding you that time is enough. And also you've been deluded that reason is enough because the Taoists neither endorse time nor reason. But they also do say that you can, in fact, have all knowing. And Heidegger was basically implying the same thing. But their methodology for understanding all there is to know about yourself and the universe is not done through time. So their science is completely given the pink slip right there. And it is also not done through reason. And there is the rationalists and the idealists are given the pink slip. And we now come full circle to what the shaman talked about, which is existence. in your existence in a deep and direct rapport, not the essences, not seeking what the essence of a beam of light is, or the essence behind a mountain, or the essence of the lake, you know, or the essence of a color, or the essence of human beings, looking for some spirit, looking for some Geist, looking for some otherworldly thing, or even a physical utopia. You see, all of this is nonsense. This is leading man away from the question of being. There's something about his beingness that is absolutely unique. And when a man is awakened to that, when he is awakened to what Heidegger called Das Ein, then the journey of real understanding begins, because the mind is now capable of that kind of understanding, because you've brought existence back into the equation, you see.
That's really interesting. And, you know, one thing occurred to me as well, that's just simple observation about the world around you, learning and studying your surrounding, obviously, and that can be done from multiple, you know, or in different ways, of course, but basically pointing out the absurdity of where the world is heading and pointing out the insanity of it all, you know, kind of, if you, as long as you don't identify it, I'm wondering am I insane then? Because the world seems to be, you know, what the relationship is there. But in one way, to me, it's like you can simply point out the absurdity of the world, learn and study it to kind of, and that's enough to remove yourself from it, that they can continue in their madness, in their way. But I'm here, I'm doing what I'm doing, and I'm watching it from my end, from my perspective, you know, for me at least. What do you think, Michael?
Extremely important. This is what Ayn Rand talked about the egoistic man, that the egoistic man understands the importance of his own existence, vitally. But you see, once we, let's take it apophatically, discover why it is that you can't do those things. Instead of trying to attain it in a masculine way, you just sit and start to discover what it is about you, how you've been conditioned to not imagine this. Why do you believe, you know, that one minute there's everything to learn, and then you never took it on board, the fact that you have a extremely limited up here, I mean, simply axiomatic, that it can't be done. It simply can't be done, not by any scientist, not by any expert. And by embodying that, by still thinking that you can, you are now endorsing collectivism. You are now actually handing them bricks to build a new world order. Of course, they will keep promising you, don't they, that one day they'll have a supercomputer that'll be even put in your brain or your little chip, yeah. And you'll have instant access to all there is to know about everything, all this nonsense.
Right. So that's the allure, obviously, that they're giving us. So again, that's the reason for moving into the collectivist, you know, world, pretty much, because that will open up and it will give us answers that we never had before. That's the promise, at least.
This is the beautiful carrot that they're offering you, because they know, again, that man inwardly knows what I'm talking about, that there's a big contradiction here. But when the ego has existed, remember we talked about the subjectivity aspect?
Mm-hmm.
This has five negatives that come with subjectivity. One, I can go through a few of them if we have time.
Yeah.
One is the first one we've already talked about, which is that the moment that you have a subjective ego, nature is positioned externally. It's foreign to you, basically, in substance and form. The second negative thing is that the subjective self, the ego, can now set the parameters of how the world of reality will be viewed. Meaning that you're not seeing the world as it really is. You're deciding, it's like you creating a little cinema window, and all reality has to pass in front of that window. Remember that the metaphor of the three blind men feeling a elephant, and everyone had to report what they thought it was?
I never heard that one, actually, I know.
Yeah, it's an Indian metaphor about an elephant is brought in front of three blind men, and each man is told to go and feel this elephant. They don't know what it is. And then they're all meant to describe it being blind. And each one, of course, writes down one, it's a large mouse. I don't know. They come up with all sorts of weird, you know, it's a snake, it's a serpent, you know. So this is what the mind is doing to reality. It's asking, it's like camera obscura. Yeah. And everything in reality is meant to pass by this little window. But you've set the length, breadth, and heights and focus of that. The ego is now given this, and it's called freedom. The ego is now given the freedom to do that.
Hmm.
People can think about that. The next thing that happens is that the ego can do the same thing with its own vision of self. The ego has not only put a window vista to the world like that, it has put the similar vista with prearranged coordinates to the unconscious, or like we said, the greater self. So it monitors and polices and censors and filters a man's vision of his own self, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the last thing that it does, one of the other things that it does anyway, by the way, not to forget saying that by filtering the world, what the mind ends up with then after 13 years, 20 years, whatever, is it all of its own content about what it feels the world is. It set those parameters to monitor the world so that it could gain an understanding of what the world is. In the end, Henrik, the understanding of what the world is becomes more important than what the world is.
Yeah, well, exactly. And again, I come from the point of view that this, there's a reason and a function for that from the brain's point of view, because I think that if we would have opened the floodgates, so to speak, where we take in everything, it would just be too much, meaning that the limited point of view that we have is actually, it's actually very good, but we cannot allow ourselves to be defined by it as well. We need to know that it is limited and for what reasons it's limited. And when we realize that, maybe then we can consciously begin to expand, you know, and get the full perspective. You know what I mean?
Although I would say that that comes from the influence of the Mysterium.
Explain.
The idea that we think that if we were left to open to the world and all the stimuli, it would be too much is an illusion.
Hmm.
It is that way for the ego, but then the ego is the Mysterium haunted thing. It's setting the parameters of what we know.
Mm-hmm.
So one has to sort of doubt that. I don't think so. I think that if you actually could get rid or downplay the ego, or at least put it in its own place or remove these parameters, you might have a completely different experience. But then again, you know.
Oh, well, obviously, absolutely. And it's very interesting, that idea, actually. I haven't thought about that.
But one of the last things is that we've got to notice that the mind, because it is now filled with these ideas about world, that it is already filtered and arranged in a hierarchical model, that storage becomes those that data about the world then becomes the world. So what I see, it ties into your first question about where we're heading with technology. This is a technological arrangement, because the ego has acted technologically. It has filtered and screened out the data of the world and arranged it in a certain hierarchical form. That form then becomes more important than the world as it really is. And as time goes by, man is actually losing reality. And this is why you even have, in the last 20, 30 years, the rise of things that are literally called virtual reality.
Yeah, exactly.
To me, this is the advent of computer games, of certain kinds of interactive movies. I'm not saying it's bad. I remember, we're not talking about good and bad and wrong and right. We're just saying, look at how these things arise. You plant the seed, something will grow from it.
Yeah.
All of this virtuosity and sort of a proxy and voyeurism that we see in the world, and even the technologies to make life smoother, to make life more interesting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is part of this, because man actually knows he and nature, he and reality are getting further and further apart. The global village is the ultimate concomitant of that, just like it was shown by Patrick McGoohan in The Prisoner.
That's really, really interesting. And again, the emergence of virtual reality going into games. And again, it's all about the fact that, you know, we go deeper also into the illusion, because again, if we tie it back with the ideas we talked about before, that we might already in one way be living in a computer-generated reality. I mean, it can be an organic computer in that sense, or more like just a function of it, that it operates like a computer program. But now what we're doing is that we're getting another one inside this one, and we're going just deeper and deeper into the illusion, if you know what I mean.
Right. And then the one of the last things that the subjective mind is able to do is this. It not only loses interest in with the real. Remember the time when man was connected to the noumena? Like I said, he was linked umbilically to the nature.
The bicameral mind again, basically.
Yeah. Before he was subjective. Of course, this is always the very word neter, N-E-T-E-R, meant the godly or the spiritual. In Egyptian, was the word we get nature from.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a reason for having theriomorphic gods, is because they were coming from this state in which nature and mind was one. I believe that sort of changed, again, going back to the time of Akhenaten or slightly before. But anyway, because this has happened, in the time when man was connected to nature, you might want to look at it this way, that man's face was reflected back to him directly in nature. Nature was man and man was nature. He was one. He was connected. When the ego came about, it's almost like the projection of man's own visage in nature faded. In other words, nature dropped man's image, because man was no longer there. It's literally man had ceased to exist. He's a simulacra of what man really was. Now when man is in the subjective state, he hungrily and desperately, especially since the age of trauma when the ego was born, it looked back into nature to find its face there and didn't find it.
Hmm.
Not realizing that ego is the cause. And ever since, man has been looking to find its face in nature. Not being able to find his face in nature, he became even more disturbed, and his antipathy towards nature increased.
When we start to project our image onto it, meaning that we anthropomorphize things, we put a smiley face on the sun, etc.?
That's it. Anthropomorphism is the dire consequence of a lot of historical philosophy and technology. It's even haunted many decent forms of eco-philosophy and so on and so forth. And man, through his technology, one aspect of his technology is that he is now desperately trying to embed his own face again where it is no longer there.
Right. Just explain what you mean by eco. What do you say? Eco?
Well, the eco-philosophers, you know, like the deep ecology movement and...
Right. Like, for instance, we identify with the polar bear, so that becomes the symbol of the climatic change movement. Is that what you're talking about?
No, not necessarily. I'm speaking about certain schools that are like neo-pagan, or they do want a much more holistic. They do realize that God is nature, nature is God,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they preach this, that let's get out of civilizations. You know, the sort of anarchistic model.
Okay, I see what you mean. Okay, yeah.
You know, they're good, I believe. I'm very much in favor of some of what these guys are doing. But some of them have this anthropomorphic, romantic idea, you see. And that's, again, an inauthentic way of seeing human beings there. It's not altogether negative. I mean, William Wordsworth, if you read his poetry, he's right on the ball, you know, and many of them, other ones were as well. And, of course, Rainier Maria Rilke and others who've done this, and Holderlin, there's so much beauty in the poetry that do talk about this, because they're not victims of the technological mindset, of course. The poets are, by definition, even Heidegger agreed, the ones who are back in a natural rapport with the natural. But when you're not, you then, through technology, force your footprint onto nature.
Mm.
And this is what then is happening now with all of these colonializations and colonizations of indigenous peoples, and making them modern and contaminating them, and putting, you know, Coca-Cola ad billboards, you know, in the jungle, and projections and all the rest of it. All of this is born out of this idea to again find man's visage, but not in a holistic way. Once upon a time, man looked into nature and saw himself. Now he wants to do it again, but in a artificial way. This is very, very deadly.
What do you make of all the, because that seems to be, I guess, an incentive or an idea right now as well, is that the world is also slowly kind of turning towards very much of the anti-consumerism. The world is turning away from, no, let's, just as you mentioned, the Coca-Cola sign in the jungle, that is frowned upon now in one way, and that's also going out the door. Where do you see, does that stem from a true, you know, point of view, do you think, or do you see some danger with the anti-consumerism, anti-industrialization that's going on now as well, Michael?
Well, I see it as pretty much positive if man can get back to some of these, you know, existential philosophical points. And don't forget that it doesn't mean that technology doesn't have a role in the lives of awakened people. And of course, didn't even the shamanic people have to use horses?
Yeah, sure, of course.
And this is technology.
Technology is even the use of entheogenic substance, for instance. That's a form of technology too, or fire, or, you know, whatever, what have you.
Making a fishing net to catch fish.
Sure, exactly.
Yeah. So it's not technology is wrong in itself. It's what it's being used for and how it's being used for. If it's being used so that the ego can gain a certain suzerainty that once upon a time the whole self had, well, then we're in deep trouble. But if the technology can aid and abet man to do this thinking process and link him back to nature as it really is, then by all means that is very, very positive.
Mm.
So the technology is ambivalent itself. It can be used for different purposes, you see.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about basically the Cartesian worldview and the Descartes and so forth?
Yeah, because Descartes is one of the idealists, rationalists, whose own process of thought exemplifies the man who's haunted by the mysterium. That's why in the article I talk about Descartes as being disciple of the mysterium, taking the Heideggerian principle that all the philosophers since Plato, including Plato, were disciples of the lie, you know, or that they had taken philosophy off in the wrong direction. And Descartes was one we studied back, we assiduously studied him back in the days when I took the classes in Belfast, and therefore we were really up to speed on his teachings. And basically what Descartes had the problem was, he sat down to basically convince himself that he existed. And his process was what we know today to be skepticism, that he would doubt everything about himself and everything about the world. He would subject all of that to rigorous doubt. And it's what later became known as the skeptical school. And his process, after a long period of time, he decided that he could be sure that he existed because of his capacity to doubt. If he could doubt, then he must be a thinking animal. And if he thought, it implied that there was a thinker there, and therefore He said, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, the famous motto. Then what where the flaw is there is that he didn't question, if you're using thought as a proof of existence, you're assuming that your thought is wholesome and rational and perfect. But what happens if it's not? Can you still then be thought to exist if your thinking was flawed in the first place?
Very difficult question. I don't think so. Right. I don't think so.
And, or at least by his own definition, you couldn't. Yeah. He might argue, no, even if my thought is deficient, I still am thinking, therefore I know I exist. But actually, if you really want to be split hairs about it, no, you can't. Because if your thinking is itself not true thought, or as if I say, thought has been perverted by the presence of the mysterium and a false sense of identity, I don't think you can use that as a justification to actually say you exist. But then Descartes moved on, because remember, in the Descartesian model, in the Cartesian model, mind, body, and world are three separate things. This is the what's called Cartesian dualism that infected all the philosophers. Remember, I told you it's because of the mask that we wear. We wear the mysterium mask, and we look out through different eyes, and therefore we can never resolve this dualism problem. But he even said that God was separate. To all rationalists and idealists, God is a separate mysterium that is even outside the mind. So the next step for Descartes was then to say, now that I know that I exist, how can I then be sure that the objects of the world exist? And he in the beginning, he was very doubtful of it. He said, I know my senses see it, but I could be deluded about it. And then after a little bit more thought, he said, oh no, I can't be deluded about it. And here's the reason. He said that God, I know that God created all, he created me, he created the reason, and he created the world. Remember, as we talked earlier, this is the mysterium of theologians. They don't say, they do not say nature created God, created man, created mind. They claim that a concept of their own minds. Now you got to really get the logic of this, or the illogic of it. They say this is rationalism for you. A figment of my own imagination that I believe is absolutely outside of my of me. It's not a mental creation, even though it is. I trust that to endorse and to verify for me that I exist. And that also the world exists. Because in Descartes' model, he said that since God has created the world, God would never lie to me. God is not a deceiver. The devil is the deceiver. God would never deceive me. And therefore, I can be sure that the world as I see it exists because God would never lie to me. And on paper, this sounded wonderful, and it started an entire school of philosophy.
So it goes back to belief again. It's all about belief. You can't prove and anything.
Right, because as we said earlier on, the thoughts of man are not nature created. They're mind created. And you can twist it in whatever way you want. In other words, but it's even something more sinister is happening there in the Cartesian model. Why did Descartes, by the same token, and as a philosopher, not say, now that I know that I think, I can be sure that the world exists. I go to my own proof for the world existing. I know that it existed because I exist. He goes to a mysterium and says, I trust the mysterium, which is the perverse creation of my own mind, and use that as the prima facie evidence that the world exists. Do you see how convoluted this becomes? Maybe even if he had come from an existentialist point of view and go, look, I just trust that the world exists because I know I do, you know, maybe he would have been onto something there, but he didn't.
Could it be that he lived in a time, because I can't recall this now, what era he lived in, could the church still be involved here in some way, meaning that he incorporated this into his worldview in order to not be, you know, I don't know, hanged or something for being a heretic?
Well, this is what we were taught. It's true. That's what Alan, my philosophy teacher, insisted, that Descartes wanted to save himself from being thrown into a dungeon and therefore had an elaborate propaganda campaign to make his own philosophy look Christianized. Because he would have been dragged out and hung, you know, I mean, really tortured. So, yes, that's part of it. But nevertheless, since that we can't be 100% sure of that, we have to go by his own philosophy. We can't think about these possible
Outcomes or versions of what he did. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, they're speculative, you see. All we can know is what the man wrote down. And as far as he's concerned, his philosophy said that God, that is not me. God is outside nature. God is the prime mover. He is not going to deceive me, so I can trust. But when we look at that from an existential point of view, it has no validity. And therefore, all forms of rationalism and idealism that arose, even the Hegelian forms and all of this, are made null and void. And in fact, they were already made null and void under their own weight. By the time of Immanuel Kant, the entire rationalistic ship had ground to a complete halt, and along came Kant to try and resolve those issues. And that itself is a very fascinating story, which, you know, we don't have time to get into.
Well, again then, Michael, to start to bring this up again then, but just to make the modern example, Climategate and all this stuff again, It's being that data is being dismissed basically in the mainstream media for the same reasons that we're talking about here. It's supposed to be science, but it actually isn't. It isn't the observance of the actual data that is taken into effect here. It's a belief that what we can see with the data that they have revealed is that it's true. So it doesn't matter if people lie or skew the data in order to prove that it's right, because we need to do something about it, and we know now that this is the case. So what I'm getting to here again is that the scientific model, the principle, and all this is more based on belief than actual observance of reality, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a reflection basically of what you're bringing up here in the past, and what this is based on has its reflections out to what we can see in the world today again.
That's right. And remember, most of the schools of philosophy, all the good that they ever created was to continually bash the other school.
Yeah, exactly.
For centuries, they were just fussing over minutiae, which had never really added anything to the world. When the atheism comes along to finally replace the rationalism and the theology, it doesn't really create anything new. Atheists don't return back to, and that includes most of the materialists and what have you today, who are behind the science world, they don't turn back to what is really the question of existence. They just create another mysterium for themselves. That mysterium shares many of the effects of the previous mysterium. You may have taken off the sort of theological edge to it, but you still have the same mysterium when it comes to psychology. In other words, like we said, the mysterium creates a false understanding of oneself.
Mm.
Well, the people who are running the world today are still disaffected by that. That didn't go out the door just because they said there's no God.
Right, right. Exactly.
Right? They still have a faulty understanding of their own existence. And secondly, they even have a deeper mysterium, which is a false understanding of nature itself.
Hmm.
Right? Nature has become the new, or not nature itself, but a perverted understanding of nature, which is partly anthropomorphic and other problem, technological, that it doesn't have a consciousness and so forth and so on, became the new form of mysterium. And see, when that one's dead, there'll be another one.
Yeah, of course. It's the new God, basically, the new religion that you're talking about, right?
Because, right.
Again, if it's true what you say about the death of Christianity and all the other religions, then, humankind might want to go for something else. They want to have something to still cling on to, a new mysterium, just as you say.
And this is what has been happening right across the board. There's many examples of this, by the way. If you study the works of many of the people who are behind this the sort of cybernetic movement and the genetics movement and what have you, you see that it is a false understanding of the body. It is a false understanding of nature that is ultimately behind what they're doing.
Yeah.
The whole idea that fixing what isn't broken and so forth and so on, this is, again, a misunderstanding of how nature operates and what nature is. And until people really understand these fundamentals, understand the depth of the delusion in which they're caught in, there's never going to be really any quantum change. Remember we said at the very beginning that this concept of the mysterium is a definition of human neurosis.
Yeah, yeah.
If we face the fact that at the time of the birth of the ego, this mysterium came into existence, it's an epiphenomena of ego existence, or it even is the ego, or it is what helps you to have this mythical, phantasmic understanding of your self-identity, then we see that anything that contradicts the programming,
the consensus
of the mysterium, yes,
is the
reason why people are becoming neurotic. Because even though you have a mysterium, it doesn't mean that nature ceases to exist. It doesn't matter, as you earlier mentioned, that the instincts, like the animals you said, operate on the instincts, remember?
Mm, yeah.
Those instincts are called archetypes from psychology. They still exist. In fact, as we said, the self exists in the deepest hemisphere of man's mind. Those things still exist and still work on the consciousness regardless of how you repress them. In fact, in many schools of psychology, including Freudian, the more you repress something, the more you set yourself up for it to work on you.
Yeah.
Take that one step further. And when we said that all repressed content works to become fate, remember that old idea that what you don't look at within yourself turns up outside of you is fate, the old Jungian principle.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see how important this is? This ties into why the Taoists probably did have this non-interference policy. They knew fine well that the man who is struggling with himself, who desperately wants to repress his true self, is up. He's not going to win that battle because that sense of self is too strong. And the very act of suppressing it, suppression is what the world does, repression is what we do. So the mind is the unconscious mind, all the content of the unconscious, is put there because of suppression by the world, to which you must conform in order to have a worldly existence. And it is repressed by your own ego in order to create a false homeostasis so that you can feel that you have this false sense of identity. But those repressed aspects of yourself have many ways of coming back and invading your consciousness and pulling you back to the true homeostasis, which man for centuries and millennia now has tried to resist, you see?
Hmm.
So the tension is then created between the non-man, the inexistent man, and the existent man. Existence, nature, will always be there. It will always creep up on you. Heisenberg said it. He goes, are we really seeing an experiment as we want to, or are we seeing... He has a quote somewhere, it's in the article I wrote, where he says, we don't see nature as it really is. You know, we see only our impressions about nature.
Yeah.
You know, Schopenhauer said, the world is my idea. You know, Hegel, others, they've all said this. So man is then trapped in this bubble. Like I said, he's wearing this mask that's been sort of nailed onto his skull that he has to deal with. And therefore, there's something about the real that always pulls you back. But it does it through a chemical divorce mechanism. It does it through deconstruction, not construction. The Taoists, the Zen, the Jains, the Druids, they all knew that because you stand in opposition to what is real, you set yourself up to attract the very forces of destruction, if you want, or deconstruction more correctly, that will work upon your falseness to drag it down. Figulus, the alchemist, he said that nothing changes unless it is first broken down to its first matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole idea that carbon is the basis and all that. Until things are broken down into their basic elements, you can never have the phoenix rise from the ashes. So what we're looking at now is the, and you were hinting at this earlier, there is something happening in nature already. There's something happening outside of man's own sphere of influence that is causing an erosion of the mechanisms. You see these false phantasms that have become created. The self will not be suppressed. It will call man back, or it will destroy him. It will destroy the constructs that he's living in the shadow of this great beast. It will literally he'll build it up and build it up and build it up, only for it to either topple again, you know, so that he comes back to the true state of existence. The man who does this through his volition, the man who does this of his own will, that's a different creature. He has to step outside the norms, the song Tom Sawyer by Rush, you know, he's got to go against the flow. His mind is not going to be for rent, you know, to any god or government.
So I guess, Michael, to summarize here a little bit of what we've been talking about, control in one way and evil, you know, forget about it. You've got nothing to worry about. Obviously, learn from it, know what it is, study it in order to not be consumed in that sense by it. But if it's meant to collapse, it will. And I guess what you're saying as well, then discover yourself. That's your recommendation here.
That's my recommendation. There are meditations that you can do, like we talked about the delusion of oneness, and to be very aware of how that term is used. There's an old adage. You see, the actual emblem of the Taoists was a thing called a tomo, and it was like the Celtic three spirals.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Right? They thought of the number three as being much more exemplary of man as an existence. That was the gateway to the noumena, as opposed to oneness. Ideas of the number one are the gateway to illusion and the gateway to the noumena. Because again, oneness is a conception of mind. Threeness actually exists. Two-ness actually exists. Right? You can have two stones, you can have two rivers, you can have two ravens, you can have three, you can have four, but you can't have one.
Mm. Well, is that kind of dovetails with the idea that everything will cast a shadow as well, in a way. If you have one thing, then it will immediately, as it's in our universe, if you will, it will cast a shadow and will become two. It will split itself in some way.
Or let's go even to the holon theory or holographic theory, whereas the thing that is seemingly one actually contains within it the entire universe.
Yeah, of course. Exactly.
It's many.
Yeah.
Right? And instead of, because they knew that there would be confusion, they didn't even use the number one as a symbol. They used the number three. And do you know that even in the Christian model, it turned out that the God who started as one ended up having to become a Trinity? Isn't there something unusual about that?
Yeah,
that
he
ended up being God, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. They couldn't even keep it as a singularity because the singularity is meaningless.
That's a good point.
This is an important aspect as well. And the threeness, don't forget that man is an expression of three, because as we said, that man is a creation of nature, but nature has ordained it, that man is created from what? Two parents. So each child that is born is a three.
Yeah, it's the sum of the two coming together. Oh,
right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. So man's hallmark, as far as nature is concerned, say you were nature and you were looking at it. Nature has ordained that every single creature and even every animal that exists is an expression of threeness. And threeness was known as delta in Greek, daleth in Hebrew, right?
Mm.
It was symbolized by the triangle. And we know how important the triangle and the three spirals were to the Druids and to so many other ancient shamanic peoples, you see. They always spoke in terms of this. The concept of the three is another way to look at that. So I also often use that as a metaphor for people to contemplate so that they understand how they have these mental abstract delusions in them and come back to sort of, you know, realize how these delusions work. And again, earlier we talked about this thing called facticity. There's actually a term in existential psychology and philosophy called facticity. And facticity is the element where you totally are in touch with your own particular existence. Like I said, go back, and if somebody can even do this physically, do it. Go back to the room in which you were born. Go back to the cot in which you laid. Go back to the first experiences that you had when you were young, and then go from there. Try to track, even if you only have to do it in your mind, then okay. But even if you can do some of this physical, look at the clothes that you once wore. Look at the pencil that you once wrote with in school. You know, these things lie in the attic, so to speak. And Heidegger was very much into this. He was always talking about how you don't see the doorknob when you open it. You have no feeling when you sit in a chair of that experience. What is the chair doing? Does it have a life of its own, you know? Why do you never contemplate your relationship with the light, with the chair that you sit on, with the knife and fork that you eat from, with your own body, with your own cells, with the way your eyes blink? With the color blue. Do you have any relationship yourself with the color green, or is it just there and everybody has a relationship with it and it's just basically invisible and you have this numbness, this comfortable numbness with everything that exists in the world? What does a tree mean for you? What was your first scent of air like when you first realized the wind is on your face and so forth and so on? These are what roots a man back in his own existence. When you go to the mountain, instead of looking at the mountain and wanting to know its essence, why don't you link with it animistically and find out what it would like to be a mountain. Get into direct communion, you see, with the thing itself, which is you. You are the holon. You are in everything and everything is in you. It's these types of contemplations that help us start get out of the illusion and to shatter this whole mysterium possession that is basically operates like a parasite on the mind of man. It is literally works very parasitically in the consciousness of human beings, and it is born out of trauma, no less as the ego was born. They're two evil twins that were born together, and in fact, they may be even indistinguishable. Even the science is there if people read Julian Jaynes and a few other people there, and especially Heidegger, because Heidegger was adamant that the philosophers who were meant to be the ones that were seeking for the truth of life and the meaning of life were utterly wrong. First of all, man is the only one who can give meaning to his life, because man is the only one who thinks up the thoughts about meaning. All that man can know is his thoughts about things. But he's also got to be able to doubt those thoughts. He's got to understand the root of where those thoughts are coming from. Are those thoughts just a product of your social persona? Are they conditioned by how other people see you and the approval ratings that you don't really have a sense of self at all? You know, all of these questions that we've tried to deal with in these three interviews need to be all taken holistically. And never forget that the ancient men said that man had in fact fallen, he's not progressing, he is falling away from the oracle or the font of all truth. So are we doing that? Are we getting further away, or are we actually getting closer? And second most important thing, to never lose the idea or the understanding, never to help your mind be deluded, both consciously or unconsciously, that you have any creation over your own mind or nature. Nature is the prime datum. Nature created God, as the Taoists are saying. They created your mind and it created man. You are the, if you want to call it, subservient, metaphysically and ontologically, to nature. And therefore, the acts that you do towards nature, personally and under the guise of technology, you are literally doing it to your creator. So one day, walk out in nature, wherever you happen to be, and say hello to your creator, because there she is, lying right in front of you every single day. When you wake up in the morning, do you ever greet the day and say, hello, day? Thank you for housing me. Thank you for being here. I am walking through you today. What relationship do we have with time? What relationship do we have to the light that greets our eyes every morning? That's just something that happens. When, you know, Heidegger used to say that when the eyes are open and you, and the light meets your eyes, it is at that moment that you must say hello. And he used the word thankfulness. And he said that the same German word for thank you is the same word, Henrik, as thinking. It's the word root for thinking and for gratitude are the same in German. So that your very thought must be an act of gratitude, first and foremost, to be embraced by the day that it is your relation. It is, you are related to it. It embraces you like a mother. And you, and everything you do and think and enjoy during the day is made possible by the day. It's not just a functional dead thing without consciousness. And in doing that, in awakening that kind of relationship, you yourself then reawaken the same kind of natural consciousness within yourself by doing that. Because one, you know, one string vibrates with the other string. The moment that you see nature as being real and alive and animate, not some essence hidden behind it, some spooky mysterium, but itself is living right there. And that each tree, each leaf is an altar to that noumena. Automatically, nature's voice, the voice of the animals, the voice of the trees, the voice of the atoms, the voice of the air, speaks to you directly, not collectively. There is no collective enlightenment. There is no collective utopia. There is no collective illumination. In the end of the scenes of the movie The Silent Flute, it was written by Bruce Lee and James Coburn. That's what they say. There is no enlightenment outside yourself. And everyone must examine in their own mind how they do, how they've been sold that lie, that there is an enlightenment, an illumination, a knowledge, a peace, a satori outside of yourself and your existence. That is evil. That is the thing that is destroying the world as we know it today.
Okay, Michael, let's begin here to round things up for this time. As always, very interesting, good points, and thank you again for coming on the program, talking about your work and research with us, Michael. Mention your website then again for us, so we know where to go.
Okay, great. And thanks a lot again, Henrik, for the opportunity, because again, this is like one of the first ever instances in which, you know, two unlikely disciplines, philosophy and conspiracy, have been tied together in this particular way. So I'm very, very grateful, you know, that you've provided the time and
absolutely
the intelligence to do that. It's a great, again, that's one of the positive, well, you can never be wholeheartedly pessimistic, because we are in times in which we can review history and review the past and review what we know about ourselves in order to, again, you know, every minute is a new beginning. Like T.S. Eliot said, in our endings is our beginning. And when we arrive at the place, we know it for the first time. So again, every moment is a potential starting ground to learning the right way and doing what is needed that, correctly, the right way.
That line, by the way, is even in Vanilla Sky, actually, if people check that out. But
is that a fact?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, well, Michael, websites for us.
Well, michaeltesorian.com, they need to click on the next button and they'll take them to these... It'll take them to the Disciples of the Mysterium article and also to the other articles there. We'll put up all the links relevant to this talk on the Red Ice page, I hope, so that people can then continue to connect the dots and look into this a little bit more. It doesn't really take a lot of time, you know, to do that. We've provided the information. And again, all feedback is welcome. So michaeltesorian.com, the contact information is there. And look out for, you know, even a future discussions along these lines, both relating to psychology and to philosophy.
Okay, there we have it. Links up on redicecreations.com as well, to originsandoracles.com, Michael's DVD series, architectsofcontrol.com, and of course, again, then the main website, michaeltesorian.com. Thank you again, Michael. Take good care, and we will continue talking more soon, okay?
Thank you, Henrik. It's a great pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That concludes our mini-series with Michael Tesorian. I want to thank you for listening and for joining us here in our members area. We will be back soon with more radio and Red Ice TV, of course, as well. Take a look at that. Links from the front page. My thanks to Fredrik, Elizabeth, and Lana. We will talk more soon. Take care, and bye-bye.